Welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. Jason Williams, Sherry Coolidge, with a sheepish grin. Silent Phil in the ones and twos. Sherry, you're in a good mood today. You're always in a good mood. But you're just smiling from ear to ear right now. What's on your mind?
It's because I'm with you. That's why.
Oh, come on. our special guest today is Hamilton County Coroner, Dr. Lakshmi Sammarco. Looking forward to having her on to discuss the new crime lab. Ask her a little bit about politics. She speaks her mind about politics and the state of her own party, a Democrat.
When I asked her to be this week's guest, and I can't believe we haven't had her on in the past, to be honest, she's like, I'm really busy moving. And I was like, oh, it doesn't take that long. She's like, moving the crime lab. And I was like, still, because that's how I roll. And she kindly agreed to do it. But I have to imagine, like, moving an entire crime lab is a bear of a job. Oof. But nonetheless, so we'll talk to her about that. She really... She championed, you know, our crime lab. Yeah. In fact, I wrote about it years ago. The crime lab was in such bad shape and just tiny.
And the one, it was up by UC, right?
Correct.
UC Medical Center.
Yeah. I'll never forget it. Like, I went on a tour with the former coroner, and he there was marijuana just laying on the floor drying because there was nowhere to put it, like from cases. And it was just, it was not a good scenario. And really, if you looked around the country, you know, other counties were like passing taxes. And to have these state of the art crime laws, you have to make sure evidence is preserved and how,
no doubt.
And for justice to be real and true. And then she, when she comes, she really just continued to champion this, and she didn't want to hear it when people are like, we don't have the money. She's like, no, 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 no. And so here we are. It's many years later. But again, I'm going to let her tell the story.
Yeah. Yeah, looking forward to having Dr. Sammarco on here in a few minutes. But first, Sherry, this is our political segment. And the goings on at City Hall, the city is getting $292 million from the federal government as part of the $1.9 trillion federal
bailout. I mean, I have to say, when that number came down, I was stunned. I didn't think that it was going to be as much as it is. And it is badly needed money. But, you know, that one, you know, bright shining moment of like, wow, this can fix a lot of ails in Cincinnati has turned into what? Chaos. Shocking.
And John Cranley's going around acting like he's Santa Claus. And, well, you know, a few weeks ago he had, what, three or four press conferences in a row in which he was announcing, oh, so-and-so arts organization's getting this amount of money and so-and-so rec center and bike trail and all these fun la-la things are going to get handouts from this federal money. But there's been no guidelines put on this money yet, and you're not seeing any of these other local governments, generally speaking, that are getting a lot of millions of dollars. They're not out there saying, oh, we're going to spend it here, here, here. We're going to give it to, you know, this arts group and this sports team and this and that. Like, everybody's sort of – most people have been sitting tight, but the mayor, what's going on there?
I mean, you do have to think the guidelines are going to be like people who were hurt in the pandemic and can prove that hurt, right? Could be recipients of this. Like, so, okay, so you could kind of guess some basic guidelines that might be there and start thinking about how you might want to spend the money. But he really just was on this big PR tour, and I was on vacation. It sounded wonderful. The Oasis bike trail, Todd Portoon's, you know, dream bike trail, I think that's a great idea. We do need to do that. The Blink, right? Who doesn't want to bring Blink back? Like, it's such amazing... weekend in Cincinnati. Of course, I wrote about the Black Lives Matter mural in front of City Hall, you know, money to repaint that and make that to be really what it needed to be from the outset. But, you know, those are the fun things. There's where I'm looking for now the serious conversation. And Councilman Steve Gooden said it Monday. Mm-hmm. Slow down.
Yeah.
Slow down. We need to have a serious conversation. You know, when Harry Black came to be the city manager with John Cranley, like he's his handpicked city manager, I sat down to interview him and I heard things like, this city needs a plan. We are going to be fiscally responsible. We're going to have 2-year budgets, 5-year plans, 10-year plans. I don't see it.
Yeah.
You know, we are flying by the seat of our pants in Cincinnati, which is fine. There's been deficits and they duct tape and bubble gum. That's a Chris Monzel saying back from my county days, the budget together, and they get things done. And there's not layoffs. Everything's fully funded. But the lack of a plan, now that there's a $292 million windfall, it seems like you would need a plan. I'm just spitballing myself here.
And before we jump over and bring on Dr. San Marco.
You're just letting me rant?
Yeah, no. I am. Because it's frustrating. It's frustrating to watch this happen. It's frustrating to see politics and pandering play into this with the current mayor who's on his way out the door. And
to higher office, perhaps?
Well, he's running for higher office.
Suggests press conference closing then.
Exactly. Running for governor, which I think he has almost no shot to win. But I guess, if you're thinking out long term, again, if you're thinking about the city and not your own interests, also, this issue 3 could pass. And what are you going to do about that? Because that $50 million, we've talked about it here on the podcast before, and folks can read all about it on Cincinnati.com and in the Inquirer, is that blows a $50 million hole in the annual operating budget or the city's budget every year. And that's going to go into effect in this next fiscal budget, which begins July 1. So what if that passes on May 4th? So you got to figure out where that $50 million for this year or this next fiscal year is going
to
come from.
To be honest, that does seem like the more pressing problem at this moment. I don't want to just – we had Matt Alter on last week talking about how devastating it would be. And yep. I do want to hear about that from the people who are going to be affected and how people will be affected. But what I need to hear from our council members is a plan.
A plan, fiscal responsibility.
What's today?
And priorities.
April, what's today? April?
April
14th. The budget is done. June 30th. All right. Now, they have said every year, they're like, we're going to vet the budget. We're going to tell you what it is, but here we are, 2 months away, right? And we really don't know what the budget looks like and whether there's a plan to deal. Should there be a $50 million decision made for it by citizens in the May 4th primary?
But how is it right now that Blink and arts things and bike trails, all of which we love, we absolutely love those things. But when we're talking about priorities, and it's like you just feel like you're banging your head against the wall when you talk about the lack or the priorities just being so out of whack. And it's been like that for years at City Hall. And at a time, and I remember you and I talking about this last year, Sherry, thinking like if ever there's a time when city council or even just governments in general are going to get their priorities straight, it's right now while you're facing these just massive pandemic-induced deficits. And remember, I remember you and I talking about, and I don't want to get too far down a rabbit because you and I can get going on this, but I remember us talking about about this time last year, if ever there's a time to start talking about a metro government or shared services, this is it. As these governments are facing crazy, never was a conversation about it among our local officials.
No,
and they're getting bailed out by the federal government.
And they are. And like, so you're getting two sets of stimulus money in two ways that it's going to be spent. And it seems to be almost getting further apart instead of closer together.
That's right. Anyway, we can chat more in this segment in the coming weeks.
Oh, and we will.
Oh, and we will. Let's bring on Dr. Lakshmi San Marco. All right, special guest time here on That's the Cincinnati Podcast. I'm pleased to welcome to the podcast for the first time the Hamilton County Coroner, Dr. Lakshmi San Marco. Dr. San Marco, how are you?
I'm great, thanks. How are you?
Good. You're calling us as you're from your new digs in Blue Ash. Is that correct? You're moving into right now?
We are, and unfortunately it has to be on my cell phone since we don't have any landlines hooked up yet. So sorry about any interference or in case the call drops.
Do you walk? Are you walking around up there and like this is a dream come true?
I just did, actually. I just gave the Butler County Coroner a tour. And, you know, we actually have known each other a long time. She was a year behind me in med school at the University of Cincinnati. And, you know, she's a neurologist and a headache specialist. And I'm a neuroradiologist. And we had worked together prior to being in these positions. So it's kind of strange. We look at each other. What are our two brain science people doing in this job?
a new $55 million crime lab for Hamilton County. You were appointed to your seat in March of 2012. Goodness, 9 years ago? Is that? Yeah, nine years on the job.
Jason, you're aging me.
No, not at all. But what I'm getting at is that you have been pushing for this and pushing for this, and you have been, you did not let up on the need for this really since day one, right?
Yeah. You know, my first day in the office, I got into the office, and you know, I had been inside the old building only twice in my life, and that was when I was a second year medical student at the University of Cincinnati. We had to, as part of our requirement, that we observe two autopsies. So I had been in that building, but just downstairs in the autopsy suite as a medical student. I had never been up in the administrative area or the public area. And I remember walking into that office and sitting down at my desk, and there was a spiral bound notebook type of thing on my desk. And it was an assessment that had been ordered by the Board of Commissioners and at the behest of the previous coroner, Dr. Bhatti, about the building, its shortcomings, the lack of space, the lack of electricity, and all of the things that it really needed. It was about I think it was 56, 57 pages long. And so that was my first day when I sat down at my desk. This was there. So I started flipping through it, and that's when it started. I mean, I started reading their assessment, reading what their concerns, their safety concerns, their security concerns, and, you know, basically the conditions that the scientists and the staff in the office had been working under. And said, this cannot be. And that was before I even walked around the building. So, wow. And then walking around, getting, taking a tour of the building, meeting some of the staff, and it was actually worse than what was in that spiral bound notebook.
Couple things on how does, and you're brand new to the job, the politics of the job, had you been involved in politics? And I know it's a unique position in politics in that you're a medical doctor. And had you been involved in politics prior to that? And I guess what I'm getting at is, how did your political acumen play into you getting this ultimately built? And or how does that play in, or did it play into it at all? Sorry, I'm like going all over the place.
I don't know that I had any. I had never, ever, ever made any inroads into politics, nor did I have any desire to do so. I had always avoided politics like the plague, whether it was, you know, in a hospital setting or, you know, in the political world, period. It was nothing that interested me. You know, and I think of myself, and I get to ask this question. I think of myself first as, you know, a mother, a wife, a physician, a daughter, and anything else politics wise. I never think of myself as a politician. I just don't. It's not a big part of what I do. I guess in my job, I look at what needs to be done. What do I need to do to get there? And that's probably every physician out there, you know, every medical student. Most of us are competitive driven people that you have to be to get into medical school to start with, and then, you know, to get into a residency, finish a residency, and in my case, a fellowship, and then get out there in the world. I mean, what specialty, what career doesn't have some competition? But I think for me, I was an engineer in undergrad too. I think it's a more of, okay, we have a problem here. What do we need to do to solve this problem? And how do we get there? Who do we need to talk to? How does this happen? I had to learn a lot about the politics of, county government, a lot about budgets and finances and bond issuing and so forth that I never knew before. So it was all brand new for me. So, you know, asking me the question about, you know, how much do politics play? And when I didn't look at it as politics. I looked at it as we have a problem and we need to fix it. And what do we need to do to get there?
How did you come to be the coroner? I know this story, but I would like you to share it with our listeners because it wasn't really what was on your mind at the time, but it's a calling, I think you've told me.
Yeah, it wasn't. I never ever thought of being the coroner. In fact, I, like a lot of the general public, probably had very little idea of exactly what the coroner does or what the role entailed, except for, you know, doing autopsies and death investigations and then what you see on CSI or Bones or whatever you watch. I mean, I think that a lot of what we understand about this office is shaped anymore by what's on TV and on Netflix or whatnot. But the previous coroner happened to be, Dr. Bhatti happened to be a very close friend of the family's. And growing up here in Cincinnati, you know, a little Indian kid from India, there were not that many Indian families in Cincinnati growing up here in the 70s. And so we were pretty close to the ones that were here. And Dr. Bhatti's family was one of them. And when I was medical school, I started medical school planning on being an OBGYN. I wanted to bring babies into the world. I thought that would be the coolest job. And that's what I intended to do. And third year of medical school, I rotated at Good Samaritan Hospital on the OB rotation, and Dr. Bhatti was there, and he let me do a lot of surgery with him and rotate with him and shadow him and see patients, and I think we had a great relationship. In our tradition, your parents' friends, you always call them auntie and uncle, so he was always Uncle Bhatti, but he was always interested in politics. He was always interested in leadership and for the Indian community to have a voice and to be recognized. And I think he would give us kids little lectures where he could, you know, put in little pieces of information that we can absorb and would really discuss about our responsibility to our community and being represented and being able to represent and taking some leadership roles. And then he did it by example. You know, when there was an opportunity that came up when Dr. Owens took another position and the party had to appoint somebody to become coroner, he stepped up and he asked, there were a lot of people that helped him, but Michelle Young was somebody that he had reached out to help him.
An Inquirer Woman of the Year.
Yeah, Inquirer Woman of the Year. And Michelle was really instrumental in gathering a lot of support for him and helping him get that position and being there to help him when he needed it. And then in February of 2012, he had a medical procedure, and then shortly afterwards, he was attending a meeting, and he basically collapsed and hit his head, and was in the hospital for quite a while, and he died shortly thereafter, and the party needed to put somebody in within 5 days, I think it was, in order to get a name on the ballot. Michelle's son and my son played hockey together, and they were on the same team, and we happened to be at a hockey game, and we were talking about Dr. Bhatti and the sadness of his loss, and then she looked at me and she said, "I think you should do it."
I can hear her voice saying that.
And I looked at her and I said, do what? You should be cornered. I'm like, what? Are you crazy? What do I know about being cornered? She goes, no, I think you'd be great at it. I'm like, okay, no. And I said, I'm a neuroradiologist. I know zero about, you know, being death investigations or being a coroner. And she goes, it's not all about that. I mean, it's a, you know, Dr. Bhatti told me it's a different kind of a role, and it's a leadership role, but, you know, it's more than that. And it's more than just about death. And my husband was out of town. And I was on the phone with him and I said, oh, can you believe Michelle said, you know, I should think about being coroner. And there was a little pause on the phone and he said, yeah, actually, I think that'd be a great idea. I think you should do it. I'm like, what? You know, here I go again. And I'm like, really? And it wasn't, you know, until sort of he encouraged me to sort of look into it and said, at least get some information. So I, you know, I thought, oh, maybe. And, you know, I kind of talked to my parents, and my parents were against it because they really didn't want me in a public role. I think they were just afraid about the stresses of being in that kind of a public role. And my mom was encouraging. My dad was the one like, oh, I don't know. You got enough on your plate. But my mom was always very encouraging. And so that started it. And I had a conversation with Dr. Owens, and I said, you know, tell me about your job. Tell me about what you did. What does this role entail before I even seriously consider it and see if I have the skill set that can do it? And he encouraged me as well. And, you know, I reminded him, he was my professor in medical school. First year of medical school, I remember him giving lectures. And I said, you probably don't remember me from that. But when he said, and he goes, oh, my God, I feel old. And I said, I'm just asking. And so that started it. And then when the party, party met with several of us to consider who to nominate, and Michelle was really an integral support. I mean, she rounded up the support for me, people I didn't know, people she knew. She talked to them, talked me up. And I looked at her because of some of this. I'm like, I don't think I can live up to what you're saying about me. she really had the vision to push me as well as a party to nominate me for the position.
I mean, once you did win, how tough was it really to see, you know, that side of our society, the death, and there's been some awful things, and the opiate pandemic that we had even before our actual pandemic. You're on the front lines of that. What was it like, you know, kind of seeing that for the first time?
I had no idea what I was getting myself into, to be honest. In the first 2 weeks of being coroner, we had three very young child deaths. We had, you know, a 3-month-old, a 4-month-old, and a 2-year-old. And they were all abuse deaths. And that I lost a lot of sleep. And I came in one day and I told my sister Andrea, I said, I don't think I can do this. I don't think I can do this job. I can't just, I was losing a lot of sleep. I couldn't keep their little faces, you know, from appearing. When I closed my eyes, I could just see their faces. The little boy, I still remember his name, but I remember walking into the autopsy room. And the pathologist was standing there, and all I could see was this little boy's head with little blonde hair on the other side, and then his little feet and his little toes and his pudgy little toes on the other side. And that was just so hard walking, just continuing to walk straight up to the table to where they were doing the autopsy on this little 2-year-old. And, it's as a mom, it was very hard for me to look at these babies and what had been done to them and just, you know, not feel desolate about what's happened to them and the horrors and the, it was hard for me to imagine the pain that they had gone through, especially this little boy. And it made me angry. It made me sad. It, infuriated me all at the same time. And it was just such an emotional, you know, it just event for me. And I just, I don't think I can do this. I mean, God, there were three baby deaths in less than 2.5 weeks. And I just, and, you know, I came into the office and I was just sitting there going, I'm not sure I can do this. I think I better tell the party they better find somebody else to do this job because, I'm going to be temporary. There's no way I can keep this up. And my staff all lied to me. They told me, oh, this is so rare. We hardly ever see them. We only have 4 or 5 cases a year at most. And just hang in there. It's just a weird cluster we've had. But, you know, it's really not that bad. They lied. We had, I think, 8 cases in a 6-month period. I just looked at them. I'm like, you guys lied to me.
That was a hard period. And honestly, I do understand how you feel. You know, I covered courts up until my son was born. And I covered police for a little bit after that, and then it was time really to change. Like, it was hard to see that and as a mother, and you see your own child and understand what a child looks and feels like in your arms, and that to grapple with the abuse that is out there. Like, I became the county reporter, and now I'm the city hall reporter. And, yes, my coverage touches on sad and terrible and horrific things like that sometimes, but it is not my daily life. I mean, how have you come to like live with that?
I don't, sorry about that.
Please be advised there is a water issue.
Don't worry about
I
that.
Love that. Oh, you're moving you're into good. A new building.
I know. Sorry about that.
What's the situation? Attention, you're aware.
Sorry about that.
So you're good.
We're still having issues at our new building, and you know, they're making announcements overhead about a water issue. Don't use the toilets.
Always wait. That's always a good warning.
Sorry about that. So yeah, I think it was just a really it took a lot of months. I mean, and this was also an election year, and I didn't know the first thing about campaigns or elections or anything like that. And, you know, I remember having a conversation with one of the city councilmen at that time at an event, and he looked at me and he said, and this was March 6th or no, I'm sorry. It was the weekend after I started. And he looked at me and he said, so have you started campaigning yet? And I'm like, I said, what do you mean? Well, you got an election in November, right? And I said, well, yeah, I mean, I kind of said I might see it through or they could try and find somebody else. But right now I'm just trying to figure out all the names of the people in my office, you know, and what they do and what I'm supposed to do in the office. I'm just trying to learn the job. And he looked at me and he laughed. And he said, well, you better start campaigning or you're not going to have a chance in November. And literally he said, you better stop working and start campaigning or you're not going to have a chance in November. And I just looked at him. I said, look, I'm just a simple physician. You give me a problem, you give me a job to do, and that's what I'm going to concentrate on doing. Right now, I got to figure out what I'm supposed to be doing and what my office and my staff need. And if that means that, you know, I don't know what to do, I mean, Michelle's going to help me with the campaign, but I really can't concentrate on that right now. There are just so many things going on in the office that I need to learn. And that's where I went. You were asking me about politics. That has always been my attitude is, you know, I have a job to do here and I need to do this job to the best of my abilities. And I need to help my staff get what they need to do their jobs to the best of their abilities. And, you know, a lot of that has been trying to get this new facility.
Well, you certainly to get a $55 million new crime lab that you've been you're good at your job and you're good at the politics too, because that's no small feat.
Well, this community, this region, and we are a regional crime lab, desperately needed a facility that could perform the tests and the kind of investigations that we need to keep the community safe. And I think you ask any chief in Hamilton County or in the adjacent areas about how important the crime lab work is for them to be able to get their evidence processed and processed quickly and accurately so that they can bring people to justice and bring security and safety to the community. The entire project was $55 million, but the actual construction was $39 million. The facility is just shy of 90,000 square feet compared to our current 35,000 square feet.
Wow.
But the efficiencies that we were able to build into this, being able to build it from scratch, they're just outstanding. And this building is going to be, once they get the water problem fixed here, this building is going to be around and still state of the art for many, many years to come. And I've heard from the Smith Group, which is the crime lab design firm that that were used to design this facility out of Phoenix, Arizona. I've heard from them that they've already put in for a design award for the building and for the efficiencies. And, you know, the things that are in this building, the way it functions, the way it flows is not architects. It's our people. It's all the staff. Every single person was given an opportunity to express their likes and dislikes. If you had an ideal situation, what would it be? You know, what kinds of things? And people came up with the most innovative ideas about how, about their job, their position, their section, and what would make it better. And that's what makes this place so great, is we have people that were so creative and came up with some great ways to deal with common problems that it wasn't the architects and those design people. It was the people that actually do the jobs that made the difference in making this place the way it is.
I want to jump back and, you know, like you've talked about your evolution in politics and campaigning, and you're someone who hunkers down and does your job. And I have great respect for that. And you pick and choose times when you speak up about the political stuff. And you did that last year. You raised concerns about the party with Jim Neal and the primary and the process around Jim Neal not getting endorsed. And talk about that. And I don't recall, I really feel like probably through your political career, that was really the first time you were pretty outspoken, right? Or about a political thing.
Yeah, I think, you know, I've always believed that you should stand up for what you feel is right. And I really believe that Jim Neal had done a great job for this county, and he has a good heart, and he gave it his all as far as what he could do for the people of this county and in that position. I realized there were political faux pas along the way, and I felt bad for him that he got caught up in that storm, but I didn't feel that it was disloyal. I think that he's a pretty genuine person that really wouldn't hurt anybody or anything if he intentionally. And I think that there were some things that he did unintentionally that caused some raised eyebrows in the party. And I did. I stood up for him because I felt that it was unintentional. I don't think he ever meant to offend anybody. And I don't think he really looked at, you know, his being in any particular rally as, I don't think he thought it all through, to tell you the truth. And I don't think his mind worked along that political, oh, wait, if I take this step, will this be something bad that comes back to bite me? I don't think he is that way. And I think I just felt like he didn't have the support for what he did for our community. I thought he deserved more support, and I thought he deserved our loyalty. And that's why I stood up for him, because I said, you know, I'm not even talking about any other candidates. I'm just talking about Jim Neal and what he did for us. And I felt it was important to stand by him because we worked well together, and I thought he was a great sheriff for this county.
And you and Sheriff, now former Sheriff Neal, had worked really closely on fighting the opioid crisis.
We did.
And along those same lines, you've also been outspoken about some of the far left progressives, really trying to take over the party, and talk about that too. And I think kind of along these same lines, when you spoke up for Jim Neal, you kind of spoke out against, some people would call it the wokeness of the Democratic Party. Talk about that as well.
As a woman of color and an immigrant kid, and somebody who grew up brown in a predominantly white city in the 70s, grew up with pigtails, and I'm not Christian, I'm Hindu, and I'm different. I grew up different in this town. It was really hard to be different in Cincinnati in the 70s. It really was. And I don't really feel like I grew into my skin and appreciated all of my advantages as far as my culture until I left Cincinnati and felt comfortable in my skin to be able to come back and say, this is who I am. And I'm proud of being an Indian. I'm proud of being Hindu. I am proud to represent my culture, my community, and all the strengths and all the closeness, and would love to have all of you celebrate our differences and our culture and what we represent. And so I feel like, Indians are probably one of the smallest minorities in this country. And I really feel like as an ethnic group, that we contribute a great deal to all sorts of professions. And, but we don't really get recognized a whole lot. Now it's different than 30, 40, 50 years ago. Right. But it's been a long time growing. And what I've realized is that if we don't act as a community, as a unified community, no matter what color your skin is or what religion you are or what culture you're from, then all we do is weaken the community. And I feel like stressing those differences in our community and pushing people away for being different, it significantly weakens our community. We cannot accomplish great things unless we're unified. And every effort that every single group, every single political group makes to separate us weakens us. And that's what I've been fighting against. It's like, oh, do not talk about why so-and-so is so different or so-and-so. Why don't you talk about what we have in common, what we're trying to do? This is what'll bring strength to our community. And this is what's going to progress. This is what's going to make us move forward and be better for the next generation, because I think it's really important.
Very well said. And I know you've been frustrated by the constant focus, and you and I have talked before, and you've expressed this publicly about the constant focus on identity politics, and really appreciate you sharing your perspective on that.
Yeah, I think that as a whole, this country really needs to concentrate on what makes us Americans, not what makes us different.
Really, thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. San Marco, and always enjoy talking with you. And really, congratulations on all the work you've done, not on your day-to-day work, but also on the work that you had to do and to get in this crime lab. And it's just amazing. I know you've spent so much time and effort and energy, and you know, and to top it off from the taxpayer standpoint, it got done without having to raise any taxes.
Yeah. And that was important to me too, because most people will tell you, and actually Michelle will tell you, I'm a Costco shopper. very economical, very fiscally conservative. And it was important to me when we were building this building that we, you know, look at those kind of things. So there's a lot of stuff that we put in here that people would look at and say, well, why didn't you go this way? I'm like, because it was a lot more expensive and we didn't need it. You know, and they just kind of scratch our heads and walk away. But that's the bottom line is, you know, we made it a building that I think this county can be proud of for a very long time. We made it state of the art, and we did it absolutely as economically as possible. And that was, you know, sort of supervising every step of the way and fighting with the people that I needed to fight with to make it what I think is just a phenomenal building. And I can't wait to show you guys. I think that, and we will have public tours, unlike, you know, the old building where we couldn't. We're going to be able to take public through here. I am so excited to take my first science class through here. You know, stick with the chemistry and the boring stuff, because look at all this really cool stuff you can do when you do that. And that's part of the excitement for me, is to be able to have the community participate in what we do.
Hey, thanks so much, Dr. San Marco, and we'll catch you soon.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks again to Dr. San Marco, and always enjoy chatting with her, and appreciate her coming on today. And Sherry, that brings us to the fun segment of our show. Show? Is it a show? Episode. That's so Cincinnati moment of the week, and you are rearing to go.
I was going to have anything because we've been kind of boring lately. But it is a rainy Saturday night, and I hadn't seen my best friend in a little bit, Julie Worley. And she's like, well, let's go to dinner. And somebody had mentioned to me, and I literally couldn't remember. Like on Friday, somebody mentions Maury's Tiny Cove to me. And so then it just popped into my head. And I hadn't been there in a while. And we just had the best night. We sat in the bar because we didn't have reservations. In fact, they were turning people away at the door. It was actually very socially distanced. Easily, like, more tables could have been full in there. But we, you know, we called and I get the message, right? So first I called to make reservations. You can't do it on open table. I call to make reservations, and it rings and rings, and there's no message. And so finally, though, like getting closer to dinner time, there was a message, and it was like the nicest message that was like, you've reached Maury's Tiny Cove. We're very busy tonight. There's a few more openings. Like, if you want to come, you know, it's first come, first serve, but be aware. I was like, so West Side. Honestly, this is our West Side moment.
In beautiful downtown Cheviot.
Yes.
And it literally is a tiny cove, right? It's a really small restaurant on the little business district there in Cheviot.
Yes.
But it's been around for listeners who maybe aren't familiar with it, which I can't believe they wouldn't be, because it's so Cincinnati.
1949. They're very proud, and they told us this, like, because we were talking about it, you know, and our waitress was incredible, Tiffany.
Old school steakhouse, right? Dark.
Yes. They put pickles on the table, like kind of as a starter. That's their thing. Like amazing dill, slices of dill, thick cut dill pickles, which turns out go great with martinis.
I'll take your word on that.
We sat in the bar. And for anyone who has ever sat in the bar of Maury's Tiny Cove, what is there? The antique Royal Dalton mug collection of famous people. Like just these, like, I don't want to like
beer mugs.
Yes. They are very, very special there. And so it's hard to even describe them. They're like hand painted and
ceramic. I've never been, obviously.
In the shape of people. I'll tweet out the picture of it because I was sitting like right next to it. So they were all staring at me while I was eating, but I actually loved it. And so we just had a great night. And so Maury's Tiny Cove is that so Cincinnati.
I have one pressing question.
Ask.
Is the mug collection as impressive as Burl Love's Cincinnati Reds bobblehead collection?
It's in a different way. In a different way. Although I do think that you look at both of them and know you're not allowed to touch them. Like, just like you're a child and you're like, that's the thing that you don't touch.
Yep. Well, bobbleheads are, and mugs are, that's, yeah.
They were in their collections, yes. We'll have to go. I feel like I'd love to bring you over to the west side.
I have a great friend, Randy Burning, who owns a gym right out in Cheviot. I've driven by Maury's Tiny Cove millions of times on my way to work out there back when I used to work out, like, and I would train, work out. And yeah, it's like old school steakhouse, right? It's dark in there.
No, I've been talking about it all week, so I feel like I have like 10 dates coming up where I have to go to Maury's Tiny Cove.
You feel like there should be like cigar smoke.
Definitely. There was a piano in the corner. I felt like some nights it's probably played.
How was the steak?
It was amazing. I was encouraged to get like the big steak. That's not what I wanted. To bring the leftovers home, which we had for breakfast and then for Jack.
Well, steak and eggs?
Yeah.
Nice. Nice.
It was a good weekend.
Fantastic. On that note, I think we're leaving on a good note. With Maury's Tiny Cove, go check it out in Cheviot if you are over that way. And if you don't, make a special trip. I've heard great things about Maury's Tiny Cove. And anyway, thank you for listening to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. We'll catch you next week.